Welcome to D3, the Digital 3 podcast, a podcast about the frontier technologies that are fundamentally reshaping the economy and society. My name is Chris Berg, and I'm the Director of Digital 3 at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. Digital 3 brings leading researchers, students, and the public, private, and non-profit sectors together to build the next economy. Almost every one of us has been playing with ChatGPT and other generative AI tools, and many of us have integrated it into our workflows. It seems like the ultimate consumer technology. But how are businesses and other enterprises using it? What works and what needs to be fixed? Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Professor Kok Leong Ong, who's Professor of Business Analytics at RMIT University and Director of the Enterprise AI and Data Analytics Hub. KL, thank you so much for joining me.
Very glad to be here, Chris.
KL, why don't we start there? Unlike many high-tech innovations, generative AI seemed like a technology for retail consumers first. In fact, I think it was only in August 2023 that OpenAI released ChatGPT Enterprise, which was an account for business. Obviously, for enterprise and large organizations, The ChatGPT came as a shock to them as much as it did to us. I guess my question for you then is, how in the very early stages of ChatGPT did business respond? How did it respond to that shock?
Look, this is very interesting. You're right, Chris, that it started off as a very client or end user focused piece of technology. But certainly, I think this is just the starting point. I think there's a lot that's happening. In fact, over the last 12 months, there has been, I guess, exponential development in this space. So I think, you know, as we discuss, I'll probably talk about different things that may happen and possibilities about how this will play out into the new year. But I guess one thing that businesses were looking at has been, you know, what does that mean for my business, my operations, and how can I potentially take advantage of it? That's the very first immediate response when ChatGPT was launched into the world in November, I think, 2022. But since then, I think there has been a lot of questions asked, a lot of evaluation, and people, I guess, you know, the excitement has sort of settled down a little bit. But at the same time, that is being complemented by how there is a lot of developments, not just by OpenAI, in how they're moving it from just simply a chat interface to really an ecosystem. And I'll probably sort of, I guess, draw parallels to the App Store that we will see on our iPhones. So that's the foundation technology brought about by AI. But then there's an opportunity for anybody, organizations or individuals, to be able to create custom technology that works with the AI, and then allowing an ecosystem to grow, to bring forward different types of solution. But that's still, you know, thing that's happening just sort of at the end user's space and an initiative developed by OpenAI. What has in parallel occurred is, of course, this AI's arms race. People are starting to say, look, it's not just simply ChatGPT as the only big entity that can deliver a large language model. But you're starting to see other organizations, you know, in the US, you've got Amazon coming up with Titan, Meta or Facebook coming up with Llama. But then there's also in other parts of the world, with China, for example, developing its own custom version of large language models. Similarly, I'm speaking to you from Singapore, and Singapore is also putting huge investments in creating custom versions of it in Southeast Asia. A couple of days back, I think one of the startups in India, in Bangalore, has just received some seed funding to develop an Indian version of a large language model. So there's a lot of activities that's happening in this space, but creating that foundation model that will then power all the other applications that we're seeing in this space. So many things that's happening. What's going to happen from here is really a lot of opportunities, because once you get the foundation of that AI capability, the ability to understand the human language, what are the kind of applications that you can build? That is the next frontier that, in my opinion, is going to be an exciting space that we can work on. And at the research center, we are doing the same thing. We're looking at those large language models and saying, what can we do with this in the context of solving problems for different types of stakeholders, whether that's enterprise or not-for-profit organization or for the community at large?
I guess it's such an interesting question. As I understand it, in the machine learning community, there's a debate about whether what we need is one or two really big foundation models that we then do sort of custom training on top of, or are we going to get lots of what we would call foundation models, lots of big models that are custom designed for specific use cases? And I guess the direction that you're suggesting a lot of countries are going is that we don't need one giant ChatGPT or one giant OpenAI GPT-4, we need the Indian GPT and we need the Vietnamese GPT and the Chinese GPT. Is that the sort of path that you see this industry evolving?
Yeah, I think that's at least the direction that things will happen. And I think 2024 will be the year of explosion of large language models, where everybody's trying to sort of identify a niche, right? And in this case, you can see that this is very much contextualized to the local culture of what that technology is capable of. I guess the initial early criticism of generative AI from OpenAI has been, you know, the lack of representations of minorities. So if I can draw an example of DALL-E, which is the one that allows you to generate images from descriptions, if you were to try to do this for India, for example, right, well, you might be able to get some architecture that reflects India. The human that is,
but it almost certainly there, just be the Taj Mahal, right? That's the problem.
Correct. And you're very right. And the thing is that the person in there doesn't really look, or at least in the eyes of, you know, the Indian nationals, that they are not really authentic Indians because of, you know, how the AI is trying to perceive. And that's not the fault of the AI. It's pretty much a reason because that's what you've been feeding it, the data that it's learning from. And I think it's on that basis that everybody's starting to see that, well, we've got to have something that understands the local context. You know, particularly in China, for example, the systems definitely is very different to, say, the Western culture. The language in many parts of Asia is very different to how we structure our thoughts in English. Therefore, there is all that need. But that's the explosion phase. And, you know, typical economic cycles, with that explosion, I believe there's going to be also consolidation that may happen down the track. That consolidation will come from people's realization that perhaps we don't need that many different large language models. And perhaps as we start to build applications, we realize that, you know, we only need some few very good foundation models for us to build the applications that we want to. So I think that's just a normal cycle that we are going through. But what is also interesting has been that the shift from foundation model will no doubt start to happen, building those foundation models, but it's also very costly. As you know, it takes a lot of data, it takes a lot of computing power, and it's not environmentally friendly to build large numbers of large language models. And so increasingly, people are starting to look at this and go, well, do we really want to start building all these large language models without having a real understanding for the kind of needs that it can provide, right? Ultimately, I believe that consolidation will also happen very rapidly, just as quick as the explosion, because investors is going to question the return on investment, and the investment is huge. And so that consolidation is going to quickly bring us back to focusing on what are the solutions that we can create based on this foundation model.
And I guess some of that consolidation stepping back, actually, I mean, it's very hard to talk about the economics of generative AI in the absence of talking about really NVIDIA's domination, NVIDIA the chip maker that provides the vast, overwhelming majority of the GPUs, the general processing units that feed into the development of these foundation models. I guess when you're thinking about, you know, what does the industrial structure of generative AI look like? Is that based on a hope that we're just going to get more chips or a more competitive chip market? Or is this, you know, do you foresee that the NVIDIA domination that we're seeing right now and has shaped the industry so much, that's a permanent state of affairs?
I think there will be growth, but I don't think it will continue to grow at the rate that we are seeing for a couple of reasons. First of all, the graphics processing units as GPUs there's going to be a limit to how much resourcing that we can get to build those chips, and they're not going to be easy to constantly harvest to be able to do that. So the cost of building or buying those chips are not going to sort of come down in the near, in the short term, given the global supply chain. The other problem has been that people are starting to realize that you don't really need to use the most powerful large language models. So if you look at what Google has been talking about, they come up with different sizes, right? Something like a phone, you know, you can have a small phone or a big phone. And with the large language model that Google puts forward, there's small large language models that runs on a mobile phone that doesn't consume as much computing power versus very giant model sizes that needs to be run at the back end, you know, the neuron center in the data farms. So the reason for that is because there are certain tasks that requires the AI, but it doesn't require the full complex model in order to perform a role. And in that case, the best way forward, I guess, and this is the balance between, you know, the economics and what we want out of the applications, is that perhaps we can have those smaller, lower order tasks using, you know, a smaller foundation model. So it doesn't consume so much power. It also means that it's feasible to run smarter applications on your mobile phone without having to go all the way sending information back to ChatGPT in the servers. And then reserving those super big giant foundation models for very complex tasks, you know, and that runs in a neuron center. Is that what people tend to call it now? So that big processing center that is sitting somewhere on Earth. So I think that's another development. Now, if people are starting to now focus on the applications and people start to tune and optimize, then we'll start to find that, you know, there's not going to be so much demand on having to do everything on the big neural centers, but, you know, we can use those smaller models to do it as well. And at the research center, which is the hub, the Enterprise AI and Data Analytics Hub, what we have been very keen in working on is how can we tap into those lower end models, tune them, and achieve, you know, a performance accuracy which is probably as good as the large language models. I think that's probably the direction that we want to go. And also for pragmatic reasons, if I am a small and medium enterprise, I'm not going to be able to afford those large language models, even if that's been hosted somewhere. The subscription to that is going to be expensive over longer term, particularly if you have huge amount of transactions. So what is more pragmatic is for a small and medium enterprise to be able to host its own neuron center, but not on expensive computers, but with smaller models. That means that they're able to do what they want without having to depend on, say, a big giant OpenAI. There's also another reason why businesses want to do that, because the moment you're locked into a particular ecosystem, as we all know, it becomes very hard to detach yourself. And so you're very much at the mercy of, you know, what, say, for example, OpenAI wants to do with ChatGPT. You just have to agree to any terms and conditions that they've put forward if you want to continue to do that. And increasingly, businesses are learning from their experience with cloud computing that perhaps a certain degree of autonomy, certain investment in my own private infrastructure is still necessary. And this is particularly the case with, say, banks, because the last thing they ever want is to have a compromise with the AI on customer information, and that would be a big PR disaster.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that already in the post-ChatGPT, where a lot of companies have been building on the OpenAI APIs in order to build their own applications. And OpenAI, the company, has just turned around and integrated that into ChatGPT itself. I guess the thing that it raises to my mind, KL, is the role of open source models. So really we've got two approaches to the property rights or the economics of generative AI at the moment. On the one hand, you've got these closed source models, ChatGPT, they tell us very little about what goes in to the most recent ChatGPT or the OpenAI models that underpin ChatGPT. We can only access them by paying for access through OpenAI and so forth. But then on the other hand, there are the big open source models that, in fact, have been released by Facebook's parent company, Meta, and some other ones as well, that allow anybody to do anything, and they're released open source on the internet, and you can share them around, modify as you see fit. How do you see that contest between these two approaches to AI playing out? Is one more attractive for business rather than the other? How do you think about that?
Look, I think that's the old classic question of what model or what, I guess, how you structured an application and what works for the company. So the thing about open source model is that it's very attractive upfront because it's free, right? So there's a huge temptation there for businesses to say, well, why would I want to pay for it if that model seems to work just as well or very close to what ChatGPT does? But it's the same old classic open source issue. We do not have a quality control over what that model is capable of doing. There is no guarantees around it. So yes, I'm providing it to you for free, but then if you're going to dig in and look at the terms and conditions, I'm pretty much sure that anybody who puts that forward would have a disclaimer that, you know, that they're not going to be responsible for whatever the AI is responding based on your inputs. So in some ways, you don't get a certain level of service agreement from using an open source model. You also don't get the opportunity. You might be lucky if you go with Meta and say, well, I'm getting some updates from them. But there are certain open source models where people don't necessarily provide the updates or the updates in a timely fashion in order for you to be able to use that model in a way that you want to. And so sometimes if we talk about the total cost of ownership, right? If you want to build an AI application on a free foundation model, what does that involve? It's not simply just using the model. You've got to make sure that, you know, the AI responses are kept in check. There needs to be some safety checks in place. Would that cost more to do it with an open source model compared to, say, a paid version from OpenAI? So that's a balancing act that businesses need to sort of worry about because it's not a one-off thing. So it's easy to acquire, but then the total cost of ownership, which happens throughout the maintenance cycle, that is a question that a lot of organizations need to ask and assess. And unfortunately, at this point in time, not many people really have the answer to it because everything's happening so quickly. We haven't actually figured out a way to make sure, to work out what that maintenance cost may look like, and people are experimenting it. So it's hard to know. The argument for using OpenAI or subscription of it is, of course, you know, you don't have to worry about the maintenance of it. Most of the time, given the resourcing, they are very much up to date with, you know, the updates to the foundation model. So that's a blessing. But then, as we sort of talked about earlier on, you're pretty much, you know, in the hands of what they're going to do. They can easily change the way you access your API, or they could simply, you know, increase the pricing of each transaction. That means each communication in the API, and you are pretty much stuck with a sudden cost increase. And there's not much way out other than just to, you know, suck it up and pay, because if you don't, then the alternative is that your system fails and you end up with unhappy customers. So that's all just that danger. But whichever model that we choose to, there's always the core issues, the issues like cybersecurity. No one can guarantee that if you go for a paid version or using an open source version, means that you are safer in any way, and you cannot. And there's going to be a lot of investment necessary to create a cybersecurity system around these models, and that includes safeguards. And this is something that's been interesting because if you look at what Australia as a country is doing as a nation, Australia has sort of gone into a very smart strategic positioning because they sort of realized that in terms of trying to put investments, you can't do that. You can't outdone Silicon Valley. They have lots of venture capitals to pour in to build those models. You can't, you know, outdo China in terms of speed and a large number of labor they have access to. And so, Australia has taken a very smart strategy positioning. Let's not focus on building foundation model, but let's focus on creating systems in safeguards that will protect all those models for businesses. And so we had the National AI Center that was established, and that's one of its core mission has been to sort of educate the community around, you know, the safe and responsible use of AI, but also a lot of research around how can you come up with patents to implement systems So if you follow a particular template to implementation, you are given a certain guarantee that the AI will operate in a certain safe fashion. And I think that's very important and also a smart move, because once the excitement dies down and organization starts to understand what, you know, all this AI can do, the next phase or the next question you have to ask is security. It's about safety. Because at the end of the day, you don't want to compromise customer data. You don't want to have a decision make that ends up, you know, causing the company lots of trouble because, you know, it was done in an unfair or biased manner. And that's going to create a lot of issues for the companies. So how do we prevent that is the next thing that I think a lot of organizations will focus on.
I mean, it's also something that the governments, both in Australia and around the world, are really focused on. The Biden administration released an AI executive order that was, from my reading, just extraordinarily far-reaching. Unsure about what the practical implications of that, I guess we'll see, will be. But what's your read of the policy environment in Australia to start? But it's unclear to me what the ultimate policy stance is going to be. That what's your read of the situation here?
Yeah, look, I think you're right. We haven't had a clear policy stance at this point, but I think that's also reasonable given how things are evolving very rapidly. So Australia has put up a draft AI regulation paper in June by the Minister Hewitt, and I think you can also see the level of interest, because you know that draft response received over 500 submissions from different parts of the community. And I think it's one of those submissions that has huge amount of responses compared to other draft regulatory papers that has been put up by the government. So the government, I think, is probably right in terms of taking its time to go through those submissions, trying to understand, you know, what's the best way forward. It has also taken a lot of learnings, and I think, you know, it's also done it in a way that tries to harmonize what kind of regulation is going on in other parts of the world. So I know that it has taken references from Singapore, it has taken references from the G20 paper, and also, of course, in the US as well. The challenge has been that even if Australia sort of works out its own regulation, I think globally for companies, the one thing that we need to do is to find a way to harmonize across the board. So as an example, if you talk about developing an AI product, if you're going to subject your AI product for some sort of assessment in order to meet certain risk or safety criteria, you find that that is actually very inconsistent across the world. So Australia is proposing a level of 5 levels of different risk, so from low risk to, you know, extremely dangerous, and based on the risk you then get different types of compliance or regulatory checks from the government. So this is very different from, say, in Europe, where there's only 4 levels of risk. And so if you're going to be an entrepreneur, right, and you're going to build an AI solution, or you're going to embed an AI solution in a product that you're building, and you want to use this in Australia as well as exporting that solution, the same application, to Europe, you're going to have to deal with different regulatory requirements. And so that's going to be a next kind of challenge that I can see happening. So it's not just people who are building foundation model. It's also people who are using any AI technology in their product. And if you look at what's going to happen in the next couple of years, I suspect almost every product that you're building is going to have AI in there, right? I saw a vacuum cleaner now being able to tell exactly what it is seeing in the house. So it's the robotic cleaner goes and say, well, I'm seeing a wire, and then responding accordingly based on me knowing that's a piece of wire. It's starting to happen in a lot of phones. It's starting to happen in a lot of appliances as well. So, you know, it's no longer as straightforward, right? A fridge now is no longer simply subjected to normal regulatory approval.
My fridge is my friend. Yeah.
Yes,
so that's interesting. And I think you've touched on a couple of points there. Am I right in saying that where we're landing on a lot of questions about, you know, legal liability for decision making is less on the foundation models themselves and much more on the users of the models, however they get implemented. Is that correct? And is that where you think that's where we should be landing?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a direction that we will be focusing a lot on. The explainability of it, given that these models are so complex, right? And it's far more knowledgeable than any human brain. If you look at ChatGPT, it's far more knowledgeable than any human brain that would have existed or existed before. The trouble then is, how do you then explain why a model makes a decision? And if you're using that decision within the application that you're building, or you're incorporating that into the appliance, if your fridge, for example, decides to order you 20, 24 bottles of Coke for without you telling it to,
which is not enough.
If you ask the fridge, what do you decide to? And so you will be asking for an explanation why you haven't ordered more. The explainability bit's going to be very important, because if you cannot explain it, then how can you be held accountable? And so I think a lot of organizations will be very keen to sort of explore this particular space.
I'd like to wrap up with a conversation that I think is quite close to your heart as well, which is the education sector too. I've been really delightfully and pleasantly surprised about how universities like RMIT and lots of universities around the world have actually quite aggressively embraced ChatGPT, and that's been very exciting. I guess the question that I have for you is, I know that you've done some research on the role of automated writing evaluation, which I think, if I'm right, predates ChatGPT. I guess, given that you've done this research in how we can use AI systems and data analytics to better evaluate and to help people write, how have you started thinking about where we will land in the education sector? You know, what the role of generative AI will be for students and even researchers?
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot of people who are already using the technology in the education context, or even in the research context. At least I know that people in my department, they're already talking about how fantastic it is as a research tool. I might give you a few examples, which I think was really interesting. So I spoke to an RA, a research assistant recently, and he was helping us work on experiments. We were noticing an uplift in how fast experiment results were brought back to us for discussion. And so I sort of asked him, you know, how did you sort of replicate all these experiments so quickly? And he goes, well, I had the help of ChatGPT. It's such a productivity tool in my research. And he also sort of like innocently commented, like, you know, well, with the rate that these things goes, I suspect that you probably don't hire me as the research assistant anymore, because you could just go straight to ChatGPT and ask for all experiments to be conducted for you. So that's what's happening in the research space, on top of, you know, getting help with the writing and perhaps structuring the way your thoughts about your findings in a paper format. I think broadly in the education space, coming back to just sort of, you know, what that means for, say, our undergraduates and postgraduate students, I think I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest, about, say, for example, how RMIT embraced it very quickly. We are a technology focused university. So trying to resist a development and probably something that's inevitable doesn't make sense. But also because I think we all recognize across the sector, we recognize that the way this is going to disrupt the future of work. And I think, you know, even yourself, Chris, you had a research fellow working on, you know, what that means in the future for people working with AI. And I completely agree. It's going to completely disrupt how we will work. But to give you, think about, say, a lot of the tasks that we once used to be able to do, where we teach our, say, accounting students or our management students to do, a lot of that can be quickly replaced by, you know, generative AI, because it's faster, it's more complete, it has all the information that you need. If you look at what OpenAI is doing with all those plugins, it has all up-to-date information. So the argument for a human, an intelligent human being, for example, like a executive assistant to book your air tickets, those days probably will disappear. Now, will you still need an EA? Probably yes, because, you know, you need an EA to get you the coffee, right? ChatGPT couldn't do that. Well, maybe it could by ordering the coffee on Uber. But what I'm saying is that there are a lot of tasks that, you know, that what the EA would typically do would disappear. I mean, how easy would it be for a AI to understand your preference because it lives on your mobile phone and being able to really figure out a complex itinerary that you had to communicate to your EA, and perhaps there might be mistakes, that's going to disappear. And probably more and more people are going to sort of, you know, lean towards the AI, because, you know, you don't have to tell them every single detail about your preference, about how you like to travel, what kind of hotel stay you like. The AI figures it out. Those jobs are going to basically change. So rather than us resisting it, I think it's really important for the education sector to embrace it. And I'd like to think of this as, you know, the good old days when we got Wikipedia, right? When Wikipedia first came out, we've got a lot of discussion and debate around whether Wikipedia is a credible source for referencing, whether students should be using that for your assignment work. Now, I think that discourse has already disappeared, has died out, right? We have accepted how Wikipedia has a role in academia. And I believe that's the same case for, you know, generative AI. What we don't know is how things will play out, because there's still lots of developments. Will we end up having generative AI as a great tutor that complements what a professor might teach in the class, allowing students to be able to learn more effectively? Individualized learning, I think, is one thing that generative AI will have a great impact. You know, how all this discussion about NetPlan and why our education systems don't seem to work very well. I think The Age recently had an article comparing the education system of Australia versus the multiple stream education system in Singapore, and having this debate. What I think AI will do is, we can now have very individualized tutor that basically would have the right learning pedagogy or a teaching pedagogy to guide individual students to get to the level that they want. So perhaps we don't need that kind of streaming after all, but really developing a set of technologies that will help our students learn more effectively. And that's something we cannot do with one professor, you know, teaching to a lecture theater where there's 300 other students. So that's a good balance. And I think those are the plus side that we want to focus on. Of course, there's negative bits that we need to worry about. But I have confidence that, you know, we as an educational institute, we have been around for thousands of years. We have always been able to manage this. Certainly with ChatGPT and anything else that comes, I think we will find a way to manage it as well.
We'll be able to figure out robots. Awesome. Thank you so much, KL, for joining us. My name is Chris Berg, and this is the D3 Podcast. Thank you, KL, for joining. The D3 Podcast is produced by Sally Piper and is a product of Digital 3 at RMIT University. You will hear from us again soon.